Hi, everybody. My name is Tim Heil, and I'm an alcoholic. How are y'all doing? And that would be Louisville, by the way. If you're from Louisville, it's from Louisville. And hey, Ronnie, thank you, buddy. I appreciate it. I was kind of dozing off meditating there. Whoa! Yeah. Send that boy for some assertiveness training, yeah. It is really so good to be here. This is just such a wonderful, wonderful conference. I get to go to a few of these. There's not too many of these like this, and I hope you all know this. This is a pretty, pretty classy affair, and I'm so gracious and glad to be here, and I want to thank Shirali and Clancy. I think he's not here. And if you're from Kentucky, I ran into a kid out of the pool. If you're born and raised in California, he said Louisville, Kentucky. He said, "Is that where is that dude? That's like on the other side of Las Vegas, isn't it? Something like that." Yeah, I said it's over there. It's kind of that way. That's right. And my alcoholism can catch up a little bit with me sometime, and I really was looking forward to coming here, and I'll tell you why. I have a daughter that lives out here and some really, really special friends. I'll talk about that in a minute. But they trick you. They don't tell you who else is speaking, you know. So here I come in. I'm kind of king of my home group back home, you know, and 15 years sober, and I go to the... First of all, I pick up the program when I got here, and they got a few speakers who I recognize. Some guy named Clancy, some guy named Johnny Harris, Vince Yo, guys that I grew up, Sean gets up last night with 31 years, I'm thinking, God, Shirali, could you maybe got God to bring Bill Wilson back and maybe... maybe throw Chuck Chamberlain in, too. Why not, But it's so, so special to be here. And then my daughter, my daughter lives out here. She is a member of the world-famous Pacific Group. There. And, your kids can always help you out, too. She said, Dad, don't be nervous, but don't suck either, because, she said, I got to live out here, Dad, Oh, boy. I am... But then in all truthfulness, she also grabbed my hands up in the room before we came down. And like the Alcoholics Anonymous has taught her, she said a little prayer together. And she asked her God to help my God to help me speak through him today. And, it's a special, special thing. I'll talk about that in a little bit. And, it is neat being here in Palm Springs for a guy like me that, grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. And, I grew up in an Irish Catholic family. I was the oldest of seven kids. And, I remember my daddy saying to me one time, and keep in mind I'm an Irish Catholic from Kentucky. My daddy said, Timmy, there's only three things you really need to know about living in this world. And I said, what's that, Dad? He said, well, in football, you pull for Notre Dame. Basketball, you pull for Kentucky. And you vote the straight Democratic ticket. I said, that's it. Now get out there and live, boy, And what I need to tell you, is that's a kind of a little world. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, April 12th of 1990, my world had gotten smaller than that. In fact, it was down to me, because if you weren't me, then I didn't want you in my life, and I didn't want you around me, And my world has gotten so, so big, over the last 15 years, I'm in Palm Springs, Indian Wells, for God's sakes, How does a guy like me get to a place like this? And it's only through the God's grace and Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm here today. And, I think about, that whole deal of your world expanding. I was in AA probably 6 months, and when I came in, you guys said, get a lot of guys' names, get their numbers, and I did that, because you told me to do it. And I have a little business, and about 6 months now into my alcoholism, I was out making my sales calls one day, and I called in to get my sales calls after 6 months being in AA. My secretary answered, and she said, Tim, you got some calls. I said, yeah, what are they? She said, well, Tim, Joe called, and he said, thanks for last night. Yeah, he said, Steve called, said, can he get together tonight? Yeah. Vinny called, said he could have lunch, and she said, Tim, there's one more. I said, well, go ahead and read it. She said, well, you know, Jeff called Tim, and he just wanted to tell you that, well, he loves you. And I said, Tammy, look, when I get in there, we need to have a talk, you know? You know, and in all honesty, I went in that day and I told somebody for the first time outside of Alcoholics Anonymous my story, you know. And it turned out she had a daddy who was an alcoholic, and she had a husband who was well on his way. So, you know, God has told me, and you guys told me that, you know, to stay on the firing line of life, and you don't know when your story is going to help somebody. You know, and I told you I grew up in that Irish Catholic family, you know, and my daddy was one of those Irish guys who liked to get drunk and sing, you know. Now, he only knew the first verse to any song, you know, that's like any good old drunk. But there was one little song that he used to sing, and I'm not going to sing, but the verse of the song went like this. When God made the Irish, he didn't make them much, but he made them a hell of a lot better than the goddamn Dutch. Now, what you really got to see are seven little kids singing that with their daddy when they come home, you know. My brother Danny had to take a poem in the grade school one day, and that's what he took in, you know. The nuns did not see the humor in that little rhyme, you know. You know what? The reason that little jingle is stayed in my mind, I know today, and I knew when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, because if you translate that jingle, here's what I heard. You know, I ain't much, okay, but I'm better than you, you know. If you're trying to go through life and you really don't feel like you're much, but you're trying to convince everybody that you're better than that, that's difficult. You know, makes for a rough life, makes relationships real tough, makes jobs real tough. Got to AA, you guys were talking about egomaniacs with inferiority complex. You know, and I thought, yeah, you know, I ain't much, but I'm trying to convince you guys that I'm better than that, you know. And I'm so grateful for that because I had no idea, you know, why my life was so tough. You know, and when I came to Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, boy, it's been so wonderful, you know, the people that have spoke here this week. Of course, Clancy is just very, very special always, and Sean last night, and Kay, the Al-Anon. And then, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, own version of the Oprah Winfrey story. You know, we had Cece on Friday night. You know, it's funny. I'll take your story over Oprah's anytime, you know. But, you know, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and both Johnny and Clancy were talking about the spiritual malady of alcoholism. You know, and there's some brand new people here. And, you know, I remember when I first came to AA, and in all truthfulness, what I had to tell you is I listened to what the speakers did and what they didn't do. You know, I was really interested in that because I thought if I get enough didn'ts, you know, I'm out of here. You know, so I'd come in, I'd be sitting where you're all sitting, I'd listen to the speaker. And I'd be sitting there thinking, well, I did that, and I did that, I did that, I did that, I did not do that, you know. Next night, next speaker, did it, didn't do it, did not do that. Trying desperately to find out how I was different. You know, I was about 6 weeks in AA. Lady was speaking. I identified with everything this lady was talking about. You know, I'm sitting there thinking, well, I did that, oh my God, I did that too. Right at the end, she said she used to carry a half pint in her bra. I said, I did not do that. Told some old guy about that, and he said, it sounds like you're getting a little desperate there to me, Tim. You know, and I guess the deal on that was I was kind of interested in what an alcoholic looked like. And you guys said, well, kind of like you, you know. I said, no, you know what I mean, dirty old man in a raincoat. And they said, no, we don't know what you mean. And it was confusing because I look at you now, you know, bright faces, you know, having a great time, dressed nice. Kind of hard to tell you're drunk by looking at you. Here's what happened to me, though. They said, keep coming back. And you know, Clancy talked a lot yesterday about this and why it's so important in Alcoholics Anonymous to keep the purity of what goes on here. Because, you know, this identification thing is just huge. If I didn't identify with the things I'm going to tell you about, I'm not sure I would have stuck around. Because you know what? The stories were really different. A lot of things happened to a lot of different people. But here's what happened to me. No matter what the stories were, I heard people talking about these three things. They were talking about being restless, irritable, and discontented. They were talking about being apart from, not a part of. And they were talking about progressive patterns of dishonesty in their life. You know, and when I heard you all talking about those things, what was undeniable is that those three things have been part of me from the get-go. Those three things are the things of the last 15 years that I've had to wrestle with. Restless, irritable, discontent. What the hell is that? I don't know. I just got it. Wake up with it, man. Sometimes the most powerful thing I hear anybody share in a meeting is like running to Keith. I say, Keith, how's it going? He goes, ah, Tim, I don't know, man. You know, Tim, I just got this feeling. You know, Tim, I go, yeah, I know. I know, man. See, because when I was 15 years old, I put alcohol on that, whatever that is. It took it away, and I never forgot that. I chased that for about the next 23 years. That's what that is. And the reason I need to know what that is, and then they talked about it, Clancy talked about it clearly, you know, is that when I stopped drinking, you know, guess what? Restless, irritable discontent is going to be there. Now what are you going to do with it, Tim? And, you know, the spiritual set of tools that you all have given me are what I have to use on a daily basis to deal with that. Thank God for that. You know, apart from, not a part of. You hear a lot of us talk about that. I don't know what that is either, but it's part of my disease. There's a part of me, you know, that just loves to be here, and this is just the greatest place I've ever been. There's a part of me is like, what is a guy like me doing in California with people like this? Get out of here, Tim, you know. What's that part of me that can be all alone in a room of 400 people? You know, I don't know, but I think it's part of alcoholism. You know, I'll share this. I don't know if you'll identify with this. I got 6 little grandkids today, and I like to watch movies with them. One of my favorites is E.T., the extraterrestrial. Because it takes me back in the middle 80s when that movie first came out, and I was out there rocking and rolling and drinking, and I was out at a movie this particular night with some lady that I think I was engaged to, you know, one of those deals. But E.T. was on, and I was kind of not in too good of a shape, but there's a part in the movie, if you remember, where old E.T., he gets all green and gray and crinkly, and he's drying up, man. He's dying. But all of a sudden, he looks up in the sky and he goes, home, home, E.T., home. Man, tears just started coming down my face. And this girl I was with said, what is wrong with you? I said, I know just how he feels. And obviously some of you knew how he felt too, you know. You know, I could tell that in my church group, and nobody would get it. You know, you know, and why is that so important? It's the most important thing you told me was, you know, that's going to happen, Tim, so stay in the loop of Alcoholics Anonymous. Stay in your home group. Stay in the loop of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you know what scares me the most sometimes when I first read a big book? They talked about the peculiar mental twist that precedes the first drink. But wow, I mean, what do you do about something like that? It's just going to come up one day and snap me drunk. And you know, the interesting thing about the peculiar mental twist that precedes the first drink is that I can always see it in you, but I can never see it or hear it in me. And you know, it's real simple. Because of that, I need to stay around you guys. You know, about 5 years sober, now I only know this looking back. When I was about 5 years sober, if you were around me, what you would have heard me saying were things like, you know, that sponsor I've had for the first 5 years. I mean, he was okay for a while, but boy, he's having problems. You know, I don't know what to do with this guy. I might have to get me a new one. And that home group I'm in, oh, for God's sakes, they're doing the most ridiculous things anymore. I'm probably going to have to change home group. And for God's sakes, the people are letting in Alcoholics Anonymous. Whoa. The caliber's way down since I came in. You know? Now that's what you're hearing me say. What I'm really thinking is going on, or I know is going on today, is I'm starting to back out the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been around enough guys now to hear that. You hear the setup. You hear it clearly, and you know what? It's real clear to me. I need to stay around you guys, because 5 years sober, the old timers around me, they heard that. And they would say things like, well, Tim, you know, that sponsor of yours, he just might make it, son. You know, he's 23 years sober. Why don't you give him a chance? And that home group of yours, Tim, how many people were in that when you joined? Well, I think 15. How many are in there now, Tim? Well, 150, I think. And Tim, don't worry about the caliber of people they're letting in AA. They let you in, didn't they? You know, thank God for those old guys, because they kept me close. They knew I was nuttier than a fruitcake. They heard the peculiar mental twist. You know, and that's why this is just simply a program of action. The third thing I heard all of you talking about were progressive patterns of dishonesty in your life. And when I heard that, it really grabbed me because I thought, my God, I was the guy who lied if the truth was good enough. I thought back when I was a kid, I was a good basketball player, so if I scored 20 points and you said, how many points you score? I'd say 24, Get a B on the test, what'd you get? B+, And I remember thinking, what the hell did I do that for? The truth is good enough. The truth was never good enough, and I've had to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous that that's what sobriety is based on, Tim. The truth is always good enough. I tell this little story because my wife and my daughter are sitting here in front. When I was about just newly sober, I'd gotten back with my family at the time, and my daughter, Sarah, was 13. She and I were sitting up watching The Late Show one night. Her mom went to bed, and Sarah says to me, Dad, can I order a pizza? And I said, well, honey, you better not. It's 12:45 in the morning. Your mom will go nuts. She said, oh, come on, let me. I said, all right, go ahead. She orders the pizza, 1:15 in the morning, doorbell rings, it's Pizza Man. My wife comes screaming out of the bedroom, screaming at Sarah, going, what in the hell are you doing getting a pizza at 1:15 in the morning? My daughter said, your dad said I could. My wife said, well, you say she could? I said, no. And my daughter said, Dad, you're lying. I said, I know what I do at all times. So I say all that to say this, restless, irritable, and discontent, not a part of, and progressive patterns of dishonesty in my life. What I know today is that the 12 steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous were designed, to keep me in the loop, to keep me around you people, to help me through the periods of my life to, as the book told me, I couldn't discern the truth from the false. And over the last 15 years, I've tried to learn to do that to the best I can. I grew up in an Irish Catholic family. It wasn't if you were going to drink, it was when and how good were you going to do it, interestingly enough, as it turned out, I was the first alcoholic in our family. I used to listen to stories. Seemingly, we had two types of people in our family. If you listen to my daddy and my uncles, we no alcoholics, but we had two types of people. And I heard somebody out here say this one time. We had characters and we had nervous people. And I was a kid, I'd sit around listening to my daddy and them talk about these stories, and they'd say, well, you remember the night that Uncle Pat got drunk, and remember he used to fall asleep with that shotgun next to him, and Uncle Tom was sneaking in the window, and Uncle Pat woke up and he shot him. Everybody laughed and have another drink, And my dad would say, oh, Pat was a character, And I'm thinking, Dad, he was a killer, What are you talking about? And then my grandpa on my mom's side, I look one Thanksgiving, I'm sitting there watching the football game Thanksgiving. I see old Pawpaw park his car out there and comes staggering through the front yard, and he comes through the front door, falls over the lamp right into my lap, Boy, my mom came out of there and grabbed him, took him in the bag, started giving him the right act. And I remember after he left, I asked my daddy, I said, Daddy, what's wrong with Pawpaw? And he said, Timmy, your Pawpaw's was in World War I. And when he was over there, he got a Purple Heart, and he got gassed real bad when he was over there. He ain't never been the same. I said, yeah, he got gassed at Old Forester's, gassing him. That's the only thing he gassed. I say that. The guy was in and out of VA hospital, fall down, whiskey drinking drunk, period, But, we grew up in that atmosphere where, my God, nobody wanted to be an alcoholic. Anything else would work. Also, I went for a long time and thought I'd drink like everybody else. And I found out today, if you stay around people just like yourself, it looks like you're drinking like everybody else. Had no clue about that, until I started dating and eventually got married. And I grew up in the west part of Louisville. And for many years after I got married, I really told people that my drinking problem actually was a geographical mistake I had made with my marriage. Because I married a girl from the east end of town who did not understand how people from my end of town drank. It was pretty simple to me. And I was pretty sure it was true because one of the first times I went up to meet her, her daddy, a good old man that's passed away since, he met me at the front door. And he said, hey, Tim, now this is going to make some of you ill. He said, Tim, I've been wanting to meet you, buddy. He said, how about me and you go back in the kitchen here and we'll split a beer? I said, what? We went back to the kitchen. He took a bottle of beer. He put half in the glass. He put half in the bottle. He said, you want the glass or you want the bottle? I thought, I'm going to break your neck, you son of a bitch. And I remember yelling at her all the way home, what is wrong with him? You know, people don't do that. He needs help, you know. Somewhere early in our marriage, you know, these things you think back on, her mother says to me, just out of the clear blue, can I ask you a question? I said, sure. She said, that's your 16th beer. I said, yeah, so what? She said, could you drink 16 Coca-Colas? I said, well, of course not. You get sick, you know. She said, can you drink 16 glasses of water? I said, well, no, you get all bloated and stuff, you know. You know what? I thought about that for weeks. I remember leaving there going, I don't know, man, maybe the hops metabolized different or something, I don't know. You know, I was clueless, you know, and the truth was, I liked what it did for me. I don't care what I told you, and I told you lots of things over the years. I simply liked what it did for me, you know. I had some gifts and I had some talents, you know. Again, the one thing I can tell you know, you hear a lot of us talk about this. I could shoot a basketball in the state of Kentucky if you can do that. You know, that's a big deal there, you know, and I could do that. It was kind of my thing. It was my identity. I became an all-state basketball player, eventually went to college on a Division I scholarship. Other than that, you know, I had the insides that we all talk about. I was a tall, pimply, goofy-looking, afraid-of-girls type of teenager, you know. And I say that because alcohol was just going to fill the bill for me just real fine, thank you, when I took a drink. Because, you know, it did all that magical stuff. It did for me what I could not do for myself as a teenager, you know. And I need to know that because, you know, when you talk about a spiritual malady, that's what differentiates me from the normal drinker, you know, because when I stopped drinking, obviously, if I didn't get to you people and I didn't get into a program recovery, I wasn't going to be able to live within myself. But I got a Division I, I got that scholarship to college, and that was a big deal because in my family, not only was I the first one to go to college, but to go with a scholarship with a lot of notoriety, that was a big deal. Now, and from here, I want to tell you is that, you know, I'm 18 years old, and from this point, alcohol will start to take from me everything that would ever mean anything to me. I went to that Division I school, and by the first game of my sophomore year, in those days you couldn't play as a freshman, I showed up to the first game so drunk that the other players had to hide me on the end of the bench so I wouldn't get thrown out of school. You know, I looked at that one day after I got to AA and was doing an inventory, like, and I thought, well, how the hell did that happen? You know, and it was real simple. And these are kind of two things that are real important in my whole story. I was walking down the street after class, and a guy said, you want to go get a drink? I said, well, yeah, you know. I always said yeah. And, of course, my mind said, all right, here's what we're going to do, Tim. We're going to go have a couple beers, come back, get a nap, get a shower, get up, and go to the game, you know. Didn't know anything at that time about physical allergy, mental obsession. Certainly didn't know anything about the phenomenon of craving. You know, the other thing that was involved there that really is, you'll hear through the rest of my story, was the day before, the coach had said who was going to start, who were going to be the first three substitutes. I wasn't one of them. Hurt my feelings, you know. I have this malady that I discovered in Alcoholics Anonymous since I've been here that just gives me fits, and this is what it is. I don't care if I'm on a team or if I'm in a relationship, I'm on a job, there comes a point where I start to notice that I'm not getting the respect that a man of my stature should be getting. Man, it has plagued me everywhere. You know, it happens on school, it happens in teams, it happens in jobs, even happens in AA, believe it or not. I mean, I started to notice sometime at home I'm not getting the type of respect a guy 15 years sober should be getting. And you know the difference in AA? Nobody gives a shit. And thank God for that, because you all were real clear. You said, Tim, if you want what we have, come right on in. If you don't, then go on down the street. But seriously, that malady of spirit, you know, was to plague me, and that was involved that day. And that began a cycle of me losing that, because obviously, you might guess, you know, my basketball career was not going to last very long. The significance is that I'm 19 years old, and alcohol at this point is now dictating what I'm doing, who I'm with, and where I end up on a daily basis. You know, I heard an old timer in our ASA one time when I was new, he said, you know, it was like alcohol used to be my buddy. You know, I'd throw it in the car and we would drive around and just have a great time. He said, in one day, I don't know what happened. He said, you know, I looked up. I was in the back seat. Alcohol was driving, and it was going wherever it wanted to go. And I didn't have a choice, you know. And I'm 19 years old, and that's pretty much what's happened. And what happened at that point is, you know, when you become a daily drinker and it becomes a necessity, then you have to start, you know, sacrificing the morals and the values that your family had given you. And I did have those. But if I had to steal, I stole. If I had to take tests for people, I did that. Whatever I needed to do on a daily basis to get money to buy alcohol. My nickname those days in college was the Vagabond. You know, there's a really nice nickname for a 19-year-old. And I got that nickname because I was already living that homeless type of life, you know. I might end up your place, I might end up your place, I might end up under a tree. Wherever the alcohol finished with me that day is where I ended up, you know. Came to 1970, you know, and I had enough credits to graduate. You know, my grades were awful. But if you go back to 1970, a lot of you can do that easily. A lot of you can do it real easily, you know. If you go back to 1970, there's only two things you could do at that time. You go to work or you go to war, you know. And I wasn't too interested in either one. You know, I kind of wanted to keep the party going if I could. It was kind of my idea. And, you know, I say this because as meager as all this is, as far as I saw it, my life now was on the line. There was no hiding out because my lottery number was 6, you know, and it's Vietnam or Vietnam or Vietnam. And in 1970, that was not a popular choice, as most of you know. So I thought, boy, I better do something here. You know, I better come up with a plan for my life, you know, or something's going to happen. So here was my plan, you know. I thought, what I'm going to do, I'm going to take the test to get into law school. I'm going to pass that test, I'm going to get into law school. I'm going to graduate from law school, probably run for Congress and then President of the United States. That's what I'm going to do. Now again, there's two things involved there, you know. If you're an alcoholic, it's a real short trip from, you know, street drunk to president, you know. I could get there. It did not take much, you know. And I thought, if you're going to have a plan, you know. So I went and took the test, and, you know, after drinking for 4 years, I did very poorly, and I got turned down by the law school. And now, as meager as it was, there's panic time, because now my life's really, really on the line. And I thought, Tim, you better come up with a new plan. And I came up with a new plan. I said, how about this? Why don't you stop drinking? You know, study for the test again, get somebody to help you, pass the test, you know, get into law school, Congress, President of the United States. New plan. For 5 weeks, the next 5 weeks, for the first time in 4 years, I didn't drink a drop. You know, study for that test. I actually got a tutor to help me with that test. You know, 5 weeks, and I'm hating it, folks. I got the shakes, everybody else is drinking, but my life is on the line. Came down to the day before the test. I made a slight change to my plan, you know. The new plan was, all right, I'm ready. I'm going to go out, have a couple beers so I can relax. Come back, get a good night's sleep, get up, take that test, pass that test, get into law school, Congress, President of the United States. Same plan, one little change. That was a Friday afternoon when I shut my book to go out for those two beers. I didn't get back to that campus till the following Tuesday. Found out later on, rolled around St. Louis on the city bus about a day and a half, you know, blacked out. Physical allergy, mental obsession, phenomenon of craving. You know, I spent a lifetime, you know, trying to find out where the cutoff point was with my drinking. Had no clue that it was anything about the first drink, you know, till I got to you guys in 1990. You know, I had left in 1966 to go there in all my glory, you know, the hero child of my family with a scholarship. And I came back. Well, and let me tell you what happened. An interesting thing on that law test. The night I went out drinking, that Friday night, about 2 in the morning, I realized, well, I'm not going to take the test. I better do something. And I went back to the dorm. I found a real smart guy, and I paid him $20 to go take the test for me. And I went out and stayed drunk for 3 days. Those days, you could do that pretty easy. So, he goes and takes the test. About 3 weeks later, we get the results of the test that the guy took for me. The damn guy got the highest score in the history of the law school. I think 900 was perfect. He got like an 880. You know, I got like a 480 on the one I took, you know. So now I got two scores, 400 points of difference. And I made an appointment to go see the dean because I'm thinking I better get to them before they get to me. And I'll never forget this, and I'll tell you why. I make an appointment to go see this guy. the dean sitting there as I walk in, and he never says a word the whole time I'm there. You know, he just stares at me. You know, and I did what you had to do. I had to lie. And I said, "Well, Dean, you're probably wondering about the difference in those two scores." And he just looked at me, and I knew that he knew I was lying, you know, but you just got to do what you got to do. And I said, "Well, you're probably wondering about that." See, Dean, at the last minute, I decided I didn't want to be a lawyer, and I let somebody else take the test. So how did he do? And he just looked at me, you know, and I guess here's what I want to share with you. I'm 23 years old. I don't know why I remember this, but I knew for one moment I knew the truth. And the truth, what went through my mind was, "Tim, you know what happened. You know what the deal is. It's the booze, Tim. It's the booze. It took the basketball opportunity, and it took your opportunity to go to law school because you've got the brains and you know it." You know, I don't know why I remember that. It didn't last very long. You know, I turned around, stepped out of that law office. I ran into two guys that I know. They said, "You want to get a drink?" I said, "Yeah." You know, and I was off and running. That was 1970. Didn't get here until 20 years later, you know. And one time I mentioned that to old timers. I said, "How come I didn't get it then?" And they said, "Tim, you don't get it unless you get it, you know. And it's only a gift when you get it. And thank God, you know, don't ever second guess, you know, why you didn't get it then. It wasn't meant to be your time." You know, I came back to Louisville, you know, in a very shameful position. I'd left as a hero, snuck back into town with a secret. You know, now I was going to build my adult life, you know, based on that secret, based on the point where alcohol had taken me. And I came back and I got into teaching and coaching. Now, teaching and coaching is not the best place to hide out when you're a young alcoholic, you know. That means I was a dean of students at the high school where I first taught when I came back, you know, and that meant you had to check into me in the morning if you were late or whatever the case would be. I had some real rough mornings. And these were 17 and 18-year-old boys back in these days. And this is back, I'll tell you this one story, and I want to tell you why. I was sitting there one particular morning, you know, big old tomato head just throbbing and just trying to make it through the first day or the first couple hours. And this kid comes in. This is back in the 70s, you know, when all the kids are out in the parking lot hitting a few doobies, you know, to get ready for class. And I looked up, and there's this kid standing up over my desk. He had that army jacket on, earrings. His eyes were all glazed over, and he was just kind of floating over top of my desk like this. And all of a sudden, he looked down and went, "Hey, Mr. Island, you're looking bad, dude." And I think I said something really profound like, "Hey, by God, I'm in charge here. Don't you forget that." You know, there was lots of those cases, lots of those cases. Let me tell you why I always mention that particular story. That kid from that day, this year, celebrated 20 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, I went to Destin, Florida to see him a couple years ago, and I got off the plane, and he came over to me, and he had his kids with him, and he called me Coach. He said, "Coach, come here a minute." He said, "Look, I ain't never told my kids now anything about how I was." He said, "I'll make you a deal. If you don't say anything about me, I won't say anything about you." Oh, man. And, you know, that's been a neat part of my sobriety. You know, I did the teaching coaching thing, or tried to do it for about 10 years. And, you know, I've had the opportunity to sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot of those kids I used to try to teach and coach, you know. What a blessing that's been. You know, God gives you so many opportunities to kind of redo and make up for the spots that you missed out because of your drinking, your alcoholism, you know. And let me share this with you. I love to laugh and have fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I thank all of you for your stories that helped me laugh because I needed it so much when I got here. Still do. You know, I thank each and every one of you for your story. Let me tell you about one of those kids, though, because I think it's an important part of my story. It has been an important part of my journey. About 7, 8 years ago, one of those kids came into the program, and not only had I taught and coached him in high school, I had known him since he was a little bitty kid, because his family grew up two streets from our family. They had 7 kids just like we did. He's 10 years younger than me. Came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I became a sponsor. You know, it was a great deal. You know, we went to meetings together. We did our deal, and it was so much fun. And then, but as it happens, you know, all of a sudden, after 2 years, I didn't hear from him much. You know, he stopped showing up at the meetings. He stopped calling me as frequently. And once in a while, he'd stop by my office. His name was Chris. And he stopped by my office and he'd tell me, "Tim, I'm all right. I'm all right. You know, I'm not doing many AA meetings and stuff like that. But, you know," he said, "Tim, I have joined the Big Brothers program." He said, you know, I work in the ghetto with these little kids that really need me. And it really makes me feel good, Tim. It kind of does for me what Alcoholics Anonymous does. And I said, Chris, let me tell you something, what the guys passed on to me. I've been told that I'm a drunk and I need to be around my own kind. Okay? I'm not saying the big brothers is not a good thing, you know, but I'd like to see you get around the rooms of AA. Well, that message never came home, and what happened to him was his life took a turn, as all of our lives do. And what happened to his life was he had a baby by a woman, and for the first year of that baby's life, he raised it all by himself. And then, after 1 year, she came back and took the baby and would not let him see the baby. You know, and what I witnessed was, I think what the book talks about, you know, when that obsession of mind sets up, when we get locked onto something and we know it's never going to change, and no matter what anybody says, we keep loop thinking back to the same spot. And that's what happened to him. And he got more depressed, and he kept calling me, and I kept saying, Chris, we need to get into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. 7 years ago, St. Patrick's Week, he called me on a Wednesday night, and he said, Tim, I cannot handle this anymore. I'm coming apart. I said, Chris, the only thing I need to tell you, let's get together tomorrow, and we'll get on our knees, and we'll do the third step. Because it's got to be God's thing. You know, he's the only one that can help you. I'd like to tell you that happened, but it didn't. Because later on that night, I got a call at 1 in the morning from another guy I sponsored. And he said, Tim, I'm in Chris's house, and he's dead. Now, I want to tell you what I saw that night when I went over there. I went over there, and I saw this 6'2" blonde kid that I had known since he was a little bit baby. And he was sitting in a lawn chair, and under the lawn chair was an empty quart of Jack Daniels. And in his lap was a tube that had come out of the exhaust of his car. Here's what I wanted to share with you, because I stood there for a minute, and I looked at that bottle, and I looked at his dead body. And what went through my mind was this, and this was his message he gave to me, and I want to pass this message on to you. You know, I don't care if the world lets me be the deacon of 57 churches, if it lets me be the head of the Mother Teresa fan club, if it lets me be the head of the Boy Scouts of America, if I forget, first and foremost, what I am and where I belong, you can forget about the rest. I truly believe that. I am an alcoholic, and I can do all that and be all that. And the reason I say that, you know, around our parts, I see guys I came into AA with. I don't ever see them. And I say, hey, man, how's it going? They say things like, well, Tim, involved in a little league, man, you know, real involved in my church. And I think, boy, I hope that works for you. I hope it works for you. Because, see, I'm not taking any chances. What I heard Clancy say yesterday, and I believe in my heart, there's only one thing in the history of mankind that's worked for a guy like me, and it's right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's not in my church. It's not in the Boy Scouts of America. You know, my sponsors told me, Tim, you come here because when you come here, you remember what you are. And as long as you know what you are, then you have a chance to be who you are. You know, I remember talking to his mother. Not only was he the only alcoholic in the family, he was the only one who drank. And she said to me this. She said, Timmy, that's how far back we went. She said, Timmy, I don't understand. I don't understand how a life problem could cause somebody to pick up a quart of alcohol and take their life. I don't understand. And you know what? I looked in her eyes and she did not understand. But by God, I understood. You know? I understood. You know, I always tell Chris's story because, you know, he died at 33 years old. But, you know, he gave me a story, and that's sometimes how it happens in this program. That came to me at a time that I really needed to hear it because it enabled me to recommit myself to the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I passed that on to you. Also in the 70s, I got married to my high school sweetheart. Now keep in mind, this was the lady whose daddy split the beer with me. So you're probably guessing this is not going to go too well. We got married in 1970. We got divorced for the first time in 1983. We got the divorce annulled and got remarried in 1985. Got back together in 1987, got divorced in 1990. Again, you tell people in your office that, they go, what? Share it in AA, everybody goes, oh, hell, sounds normal to us, you know. And you know, what is all that about? That's about alcoholism and everything that goes with it. I love him. I hate him. He's a good guy. He's a bad guy. If you do not know, and I know this today, I obviously didn't know it then, neither one of us did. And you got a thing called alcoholism in between your relationship. You know, it's an impossible deal. You know, and I really say that because Al-Anon which I didn't have truly a lot of respect when I got here, I guess, but boy, now do I. Because I see the sickness and how people are affected and the family disease of alcoholism, Sally. You know, and I'll tell you our story in a little bit. You know, things have happened, you know, not easily, but gradually, with your all's help, we've gotten better. Also, during the 70s, I had three beautiful kids born. And if you're a father out there, and I know a lot of you are, what about this for a gift? How about having your oldest son born on Christmas morning? And that's what happened to me in 1971, you know. What a beautiful, beautiful gift. And I miss that gift, guys. Like, I miss so many gifts, because that Christmas morning, the best I could do was be in the hospital with my head in the toilet bowl spitting up whiskey. Couldn't be in the labor room. Couldn't be there for her that day. Couldn't be there for him. I missed the gift, you know. And I missed a lot of them. And, you know, that oldest son of mine, the Christmas baby, when I got sober, he was about 16 or 17. And he was off to college. And he was a little bit angry. But I was about 6 months sober, you know, and he said one day to me before he left, he said, "Dad, can I talk with you before we leave?" I said, "Sure, son." And I'm thinking, oh, he probably wants to tell me how proud he is of me that I'm 6 months sober. So we set up this little meeting. He comes in. He said, "Dad, before I go, I just want to tell you one thing." I said, "Yes, son." He said, "I hate you, Dad." He said, "I hate you because all you think about is you." He said, "Hell, even since you stopped drinking, all you think about is you. Bye." You know, man, I was crushed. I was crushed. And I went to my meeting that weekend out in South Louisville, and I unfortunately told the wrong old-timers about this. Many of you may know a guy named Jack Sullivan, and I went into Jack. He was one of our old-timers. I said, "Jack, can you believe this kid tells me this was 6 months over?" And Jack said to me, "Let me tell you something, Tim." He said, "You will get credibility in Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time by not drinking and doing the next right thing. You hear me? One day at a time by not drinking and doing the next right thing." He said, "Hell, you drank for 25 years. You want credibility back in 6 months? Ain't happening." He said, "It doesn't happen that way, Tim. That's the way you're going to get it back." And I didn't like that. And if you're new, I'm sure you don't like to hear that. But that's been my reality. But let me tell you, you know, it is a reality. 6, 8 years into my sobriety, that little Christmas baby called me one day from Seattle. And his butt was on fire. And he knew his daddy was different. And he knew his daddy listened to him. He knew his daddy was sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, "Dad, can I come home? Can I stay with you?" You know, we were separated at the time. And he did that, you know. And we've been able, one day at a time, by me not drinking, trying to be a father, we've been able to rebuild that relationship. You know, and he's 33 years old today. And it's not where I'd like it yet, but it's a long way from "Dad, I hate you. All you think about is you." You know, I was in teaching and coaching through the 70s. I got to late 70s, and I started to notice that I wasn't getting the type of respect that a teacher of my ability should get. So I left, and I went into business on my own in the 1980s. Now, keep in mind, I got here April 12th of 1990. In the 1980s, let me give you a little capsule of the 1980s. You've already heard that we got divorced for the first time in 83, back together in 85, you know, back, divorced in 87, back together in 90. I was engaged to two other women sometime in between there. I was in the nut house twice, you know. I went through five psychiatrists. I lived 14 different places. I had 14 different business partners. I got shot at twice. I got cut with a beer bottle, and I lost $250,000. And I'm thinking, this is going okay, you know? Well, we're always kind of like the last to know, you know? '83, I got thrown out for the first time, you know? I had to go live with my mom and dad. That's a good deal. I used to run to guys I went to high school with. They said, "Hey, Tim, what are you doing nowadays?" I said, "Well, I'm president of my own company." They say, "No kidding. Where are you living?" I said, "With mom and dad." I went through five psychiatrists from 1982 to 1985, you know, and that was a real simple deal, you know. I kept them until he started talking about alcohol. I fired him and got me a new guy, you know. We're taking antidepressants and drinking whiskey and beer on a daily basis. You know, if you're on that recipe, I'm telling you, it's not a good one. It ain't going to work. You know, 1985, you know, I came to one of those points of living with mom and dad where, you know, I knew the truth. You know, you can run for a while, but sooner or later, you have those days where you know the truth, and I knew the truth. Tim, you're a bum. You're a washout. You're the hero child living with your mom and dad. You're a drunk. And my brother Tommy, who's in this program today, hauled me over to our local nut house, which is called, in our place, Our Lady of Peace. New Year's Eve of 1985, he drugged me in there. You know, and as I remember it, I'm going to share it with you. Because I was as suicidal as I've ever been. I just didn't know how to get the job done. And he dragged me into the nut ward, and they take me back, and I guess in the detox area. And these two nurses came in, as I remember. And I'm sitting there just trying to wish I was dead. And this one nurse says to me, as I remember it, "Well, honey, why don't you tell me about it?" I said, "All right, I will." And I started telling her about it, you see. I said, "Well, see, my first wife left me in 1983, and then I got engaged to this other woman and bought her this ring, and she took off of that. And then all my brothers, I mean, my family's really messed up. And did I tell you my daddy went to prison when I was 12? And I was just laying this stuff out, you know. I don't know how long we were going on. I noticed I was feeling a little bit better, you know, as time was going on. I looked at the nurses. They didn't look too good after a while, you know. But here's what I'm sharing with you. I don't know if I'm in there an hour, 2 hours, but this lady looked at me and she said, "Well, honey, you certainly have a right to feel the way you do." And I thought, "Oh my God, you are right, lady. What the hell was I thinking? If you'd had people mess over you like they messed over me and everything happened to you like it happened to me, by God, you'd drink too and be depressed." Hell, I was cured, you know. I hadn't been there 2 hours. I spent the next 16 days just trying to help everybody in the nut house. You know? I did. I remember thinking God sent me there on a mission, maybe, you know. You know, they made me head of the stress class, you know. I got a ceramic, got a blue ribbon for the best ceramic, you know. Yeah. I was all about it, you know. I'm thinking this is going good. You want to hear insanity? Halfway through that stay in the nut house, they say to me one day, "Would you like a pass out tonight?" And I must have thought he said, "You want to pass out tonight?" And I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, if you want to go out for a couple hours, you're doing so good, you know, just as long as you're back by curfew." I said, "That's great." You know, I called my best buddy. He picks me up at the nut house. We go right to the watering hole, you know. Man, slam down 6-8 beers, you know, get a couple shots of whiskey. Get us a big old bottle of wine. You know, I'm telling about all the people I'm helping over at the hospital. You know. Look at my watch. You know, it's 10:45. I said, "Hey, I got curfew at the nut house. I got to be back, you know." So we pile in the car, and he takes me back to Our Lady of Peace. And, you know, I'm getting out of the passenger side to go back in the nut house. I look back, and he's got tears coming down his face. I said, "What is wrong with you?" He said, "Tim, you don't belong in there." "I do." Oh, man. And I think I said something like, "You know, I think you're right, and when I get out of here, I'll help you." You know, and that's 1985. You know what I did? I came out of the nut house that time, and I did what I always did. I started over. I was always starting over, guys, you know. You know, new girlfriend, new place to live, new business partner. And if you listen to our stories, we're the best starter overs in the world, you know. We can't finish much. We can flat start over, dude. Got back with Gail, who is come known in my talks as my most frequent wife. We got back together in 1987, and, you know, we tried to do the outside fix. You know, we got a new house. We tried to change the scenery a little bit, and it just got worse. You know, wherever you go, there you are. She threw me out there in 1990 again, and I ended up spending the last 6 months of my drinking living in a guy's basement in the other end of town, you know. And I can't tell you anything spectacular happened there. I just did what I always did, you know, except now I was the president of my company, living in a guy's basement. And April 12th of 1990, you know, I got up like I always do. And I'm in a sales business, where people are in and out of your office all day. The phone rings almost constantly. April 12th of 1990, I showed up there at 7:30 in the morning. And I sit down in my chair like I always did. I never moved for the next 4 hours. Phone never rang one time. Nobody ever came into the office, you know. I guess, you know, the book talks about that moment of clarity. And I guess that's what it was, because I reached in the desk drawer of my desk, and there was a booklet of the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that a guy had given me 2.5 years before. you know, and I went to my first meeting in AA that day, and this whole incredible journey began for me, you know, that simply. You know, and what I want to talk to you about that journey is, you know, it's really been incredulous, and the best that I have done, you know, in the last 15 years is kind of stumble and bumble and be very human and find my way, you know, with the help of you people through this thing called life. You know, and it really amazes me because I was thinking there today with all these old-timers here, as I sit in the long-timers meeting the other day, when you're a newcomer, you know, you have these different ideas of how this thing's going to be. And I remember, I hate to admit this, in early sobriety, I thought of myself someday as an old-timer. And I had this vision of me, I'd be kind of this white-haired guy, you see, really sophisticated looking, and I'd wear these nice sweaters, you know, probably smoke a pipe, you know. You know, looking really serene, you know, and I would just sit around the meetings, you know, I wouldn't say much. Maybe about twice a year I'd say something really profound, you know. And everybody'd go, whoa, that old timer's really got it, you know. I told somebody one time I kind of thought of myself as the Perry Como of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say that because nothing has been farther from the truth, you know. 2 years sober for no apparent reason. I came home for my second birthday, and I guess the reason was I wasn't getting the type of respect that a man 2 years sober should be getting. And for no reason other than that, I just went nuts, tore my whole bedroom apart, you know, pulled at the drapes, pushed the furniture over, pushed the lamp down, screamed at the top of my lungs, you know, damn it, I don't know what to do for the rest of the day. 2 years sober, 10 o'clock on Saturday morning, and I didn't know what to do with Saturday yet. You know, what you were looking at, I remember my kids came to the door and was like, Dad, just like they used to look at me, you know, when I was drinking. What's wrong? And what was wrong was, you know what was wrong. I have the disease of alcoholism, and I had not learned to live comfortably in this thing called the world. I had hit out with alcoholics. For the first 2 years, I had hit out in Alcoholics Anonymous. And now I was going to have to get inside to where the disease truly sits and get to work. You know, 3 years sober, I got in a fist fight with my 19-year-old son, and he chipped my tooth. I'm thinking, Tim, this is not Perry Como type of stuff here, buddy. Yeah, yeah. The home office is not going to be real proud of you here, buddy. But that's been the truth, you know, and that's been my journey, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed around AA about 14 months, and I know there's some brand new people here. You know, and I was around Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't have a home group. You know, I hadn't done the steps. I was hanging on. You know, and if you'd asked me 14 months sober, if you saw me, Tim, are you happy, joyous, and free? I said, yeah. God damn it, what's your problem? Can't you tell? You know? You know, I was at a turning point. I had this little guy in my life at the time. He was my first sponsor. And he had this little saying he used to give me when I first got sober because I couldn't go to sleep. And he'd say, Tim, just remember, God is love. God is love. God is love. And every night, that's the way I went to sleep. I still do that sometimes. But I want to tell you what, at 14 months sober, God is love was not getting it done. And I thought, if I call that guy tonight and he gives me God is love one more time, I'm going to get him. You know, I am going to get him. I'm going to knock crap out of him. So sure enough, I called him the issue of the day, and he said, Tim, just remember, God is love. I said, damn it, I know he is. But I am so angry, and I am so depressed. And he said, Tim, I think you're ready. He said, Tim, listen to this. In Alcoholics Anonymous, God is love, but love is action. God is love, love is action. God is love, steps 1, 2, and 3, your powerlessness, his power. Steps 4 through 9, your simple responsibility to clean up your mess. Step 10, a perfect refresher course every day. Step 11, we hook you up with the God of your understanding. And step 12 gets you with the other guys, Tim. What do you think? Are you ready? And I said, yeah, man, I am ready because I cannot live this way without a drink of alcohol or something. You know, and that was the turning point in my life because, you know, he became my sponsor. He sent me down to what's my home group today in the inner city of Louisville, Lambton Baptist Church, and I became the coffee maker every Wednesday morning. And I did the steps, and he put me in a big book study, and I was in that big book study for 5 years. And I finally learned what what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about, you know. And you know what the exciting part was? I hated all you people in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You were having so much fun, and I was so miserable out there, you know. And now I'm in the middle of it, you know, and what a discovery. The secret is the joy, and you've seen it here this weekend, is in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. The joy is in what Chiralli does. The joy is, you know, of what everybody who put on this conference did, you know, getting hands-on in the action parts of this program. I almost missed that point. If you're new, you know, come on in. Get into the middle of this. You know, that's where the fun is. That's where the joy is. We want you here. Come on in. Also, you know, the other thing was about that, and this has been my whole thing in recovery, is that my sponsor tells me today that, you know, and I was real concerned about my feelings, thoughts, and beliefs, you know, because my feelings, thoughts, and beliefs were everything to me. Because, you know, if I didn't feel good about it, if I didn't understand it, if I didn't think it was going to work for me, then I certainly didn't want to do it, you know. And what I have to say, in all honesty, and there's something about me that hates this, over the last 15 years, probably half the time, I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was the most beautiful thing God ever created. I loved all you people, you know, and I thought it would perfectly work for a guy like me, half of the time. The other half of the time, I thought this was the most insane group of people God ever assembled, you know. It will not work for a guy like me, and I certainly don't feel good about it. But my sponsor likes to point out is that because you did the same things, Tim, you stayed sober both ways, didn't you? Thank God for that. Thank God it's not about what I feel, think, or believe. Thank God it's about what I do. And I thank guys like yourself. I thank the whole Southern California movement, which, whether people like it or not, you guys have been so instrumental in the action parts of this program. And like Sean said last night, I will tell you, it's not that way everywhere. You know, and I've been very, very lucky to be exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous in a lot of different places. And so much of what I've learned here in these rooms and from you people in this area, I try to carry back, you know, and implement in our areas. You know, my sponsor said to me one time, I'm going to talk about this a little bit. He said, Tim, you know, when you get to Alcoholics Anonymous, he said to me one day, you don't have any skills. I said, what do you mean on these skills? He said, you know, we get here, we have survival skills, and there's only really two main survival skills, fight and flee. You know, and when he said that, that really grabbed me. You know, because I thought, that's true. My whole life, I've either fought or I flee. I run or I fight and run. One combination, some combination of fight and flee. I had extreme problems, as you saw in my marriage, drunk and sober. And when we first got back together in 1994, I got sober in 90, we ended up divorcing in 1994. And as I look back on that, you know, I know a lot today that I didn't know then. I know we were both doing the very best we could, and not knowing what alcoholism was all about. But, you know, we couldn't even talk hardly. You know, I'd come home from my meetings and boom, we'd just have a fight, you know. She'd look at me, I'd look at her, and we had no way, you know, to try to hook that thing together. You know, I didn't even know what to say. And my sponsor said to me one day, he said, well, here, let me give you some little tools here, Tim, to learn how to live. And he gave me three little sayings that, you know, became important in my early sobriety. He said, Tim, why don't you say this to other people? Ask them, when they say something to you, say, well, how can I help? How can I help? You know? I thought, that's a good idea. And it shifts the deal to you. How can I help you? I said, well, wonder if you got people who don't want your help. He said, well, you're going to have to tell them, I'm sorry you feel that way. Sorry you feel that way. And he said, one more thing, Tim. Why don't you try to learn to validate people? Tell them that they may be right. You know? Now, again, you give an alcoholic those tools, it can get real dangerous. For about 6 months, I'm going around, you know, at work, at home. Well, how can I help? You know, sorry you feel that way. Hey, you might be right, you know. One Tuesday night, I leave my men's meeting just spiritually way up there. You know, I kind of flow. I fly home on my wings, fly right through the front door, you know, kind of skate into the kitchen, kind of land in the kitchen, and boy, all hell's breaking loose in that house. My wife is yelling at my daughter's yelling at my son, you know, and I go, I'm sitting there very spiritually adept. My wife comes into the kitchen, and before I could say anything, she said, don't give me that how can you help shit. I said, well, honey, I'm sorry you feel that way. She said, you asshole. I said, well, you might be right. Oh. We can take any good thing and mess it up, you know? Is there any question why we've had a hard time with our marriage, you know? Let me just share this. Very important part of my story. I lost that marriage in 1994, and very seriously. I mean, it was traumatic, you know. I mean, it's one thing when you're drinking, all of a sudden when life is not very good and you're sober, it hurts a little bit, you know. And I lost that marriage and didn't understand why. You know, I don't know if I understand why today. But I went on, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I look back on that today, and I know the deal simply was this, is I was not getting the respect that a guy 4 years sober should get. But I didn't know that then, you know, and this is what had to happen for us, you know, and I found me what I needed. You know, I needed somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous who understood me, for God's sakes, and we could run this program and live this program together. And God took care of that for me, you know, He brought somebody in my life, you know, I failed to tell my sponsors after I was engaged, which he points out to me today, but I got married in 1998 to a real good lady in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it did not go well, you know. It did not go well. In fact, it lasted 8 months, you know. You know, and I need to say this, because I guess you have different points in your sobriety where God surrenders you to a new level, you know. And what happened to me was, I mean, it brought me to my knees. Because, you know, down deep, I was, what is wrong with you, Tim? What is the deal? What is your inability to have successful relationships with the opposite sex? You know, you certainly do okay with these guys you sponsor, and you certainly do okay with these people here. What's wrong with you? You know, and all I need to say, it was a whole different level of surrender, because I didn't know. But I knew this, you know, that it was okay, that God loved me just the way He was. And here's a story, and you want to hear a love story. And I think Alcoholics Anonymous is probably, folks, the greatest love story of this century. In 1999, I left Louisville, you know, after that broken relationship, pretty much humbled, like in a way I'd never been humbled before. And I ended up going to something, I mentioned this in a meeting yesterday, called a sober vacation, which the people who run that happen to be here today. Wonderful concept, sober vacations. But I went out there. And it's interesting, there was a guy who was speaking, and it happened to be our friend Keith Carpenter and his wife Sally. And I'm sitting like in the front row, and this guy's talking about he's been married like 50 years in a row, you know. And I'm like, wow. I want to talk to that guy. And after he spoke, I got him one day, and he and I sit on the beach. And what a gentle, good man he is. And he told me, he said, Tim, you're a good man. I'm sure your wife's a good man. Sounds like to me you still love that most frequent wife of yours. I said, yeah, I do, but, you know, she doesn't want anything to do with me anymore. But the point was, you know, he brought healing to me. He made me feel whole again. He made me understand that, you know, we fall down as humans. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, we hold each other up, you know, and make sure that we understand that God loves us just where we are. I left that sober vacation in 1999, and I came back, got into the program, and recommitted myself to the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as it would have it, you know, strangely as God works, you know, because here's what I've learned about the patterns of my life. You know, I have no idea. I've never been successful in my whole life designing the patterns of Timmy's life. Every time I design a pattern, it ends up just in a mess. And my sponsor says, Tim, your job is to do the stitches and leave the pattern up to God. You do the stitches, you leave the pattern up to God. And see, that's hard for me because, you know, if I'm stitching, I want to know what I'm making. You know, what am I going to end up with here, a hat, shirt? You know, I want to know. And he says, you don't need to know. You just stitch. You just stitch. You know, and I came back to Louisville and I got to stitching. You know, I truly did. And, you know, I'm so happy when I'm just stitching, not worrying about the pattern. And a strange thing happened on my way to celibacy. that most frequent wife of mine, the mother of my children, called me one day, a couple years after that, I guess, and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm living with my dad again at that point in time." She said, "You want to go on vacation with us? I'm taking the kids down to South Carolina." And I'm like, "Well, yeah, you know, I got nothing else to do." And so we went down. We went down to South Carolina and, you know, started something really unusual. Now, keep in mind, I've known this lady since we were 17 years old. Divorced and married, you know, three different times. We go down to South Carolina. We started a new relationship. Something never happened in 17 years, but something that I learned from this man and his wife, you know. We started to be friends for the first time in our life, you know. We started actually to listen to each other. We started being concerned about being good parents. We started being concerned about being grandparents. You know, and we just dated, you know, and we became real friends. And eventually, you know, I sold my condominium and we moved in together. About 3 years ago, 2002, we were sitting around watching TV and she looked at me. I looked at her. It's like, "Well, what do you think?" November the 28th of November 28th of 2002, okay, which interestingly enough was our 34th gross anniversary. Not sure what the net is. In a very little ceremony with a guy who is in the program as a judge and my little four-year-old granddaughter as the flower girl, we got married, you know. I think probably for the first time, you know. And I want to tell you, you know, we're having such a great ride today. You know, she's here today. And we got six grandbabies, you know. And it's interesting, you know, I said to my sponsor one time, it's pretty strange stuff, huh? He said, "Tim, maybe not. Maybe not. Think about this. If our program is about anything, it's about transformation." He said, "You know, the thing about transformation, we don't know when it's going to happen, we don't know how it's going to look, and we don't know who's going to be involved." And I think that's what happened to him. I think there's been some transformation. And you know what? I think he's right. And the reason I do is that I sit around sometimes, and she's pretty much the same person. I'm sure I'm pretty much the same person. But all those things that used to be totally unacceptable, you know, about her for me, they just don't bother me anymore. And I think sometimes, what the hell was the big deal? You know, I can't believe that those things were issues. Well, all as I know, you know, I did do this right. I hung around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by doing that, I got to meet little angels. And he's not a little angel like Keith Carpenter and Sally Carpenter. You know, that's what happened to guys like me. And so nothing is impossible in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me finish up with this. I had three children. And if you're a father, if you have a baby girl, that is a very, very special and sacred relationship. In 1978, my baby girl was born, you know. She was my baby. And as she grew up, I came to understand that she truly was her daddy's girl. You know, when she was a little toddler, looking back on this, I remember her first two phrases were this, you know. One was, "I'll do it myself." And the second one was, "You're not the boss to me." And what I tell you, if you got some little ones like that, we got a spot here for them, you know. But anyway, you know, and all through our marriage travails over the years, she would come and she'd usually opt to live with her daddy, you know, and now I know why. There was something about her daddy that she was attracted to. You know, and I know today what it is. And, you know, obviously, I got into recovery and she lived with me and she went on her own journey. And she left home. And I guess about 3 years ago, we got to see her in South Carolina. We were down there and she showed up and it was pretty scary. You know, she weighed less than 100 pounds, I'm sure. Her eyes were sunken back in her head. You know, she was at the dropping off point. And she was out here in California. She had come to L.A. on a geographical to make her run, you know. And I want to tell you something. You know, I say this a lot because you talk about different levels of surrender. I have worked with lots of men in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when they call me in fits of desperation, I have no problem saying, "This is what worked for me. This is what's in the big book. you get it done. Let me tell you something. When it's your baby and she's 2,000 miles away from you, it was a whole different deal. And I had to ask myself, well, what do you think now, Tim? What do you think about this Alcoholics Anonymous? What do you think about this solution that worked for you? This solution that you give to all these pukes that call you every day. Is it good enough for her? Is it good enough for your baby? You know, and with everything in me that wanted to get on an airplane and get out here, I had to get on that phone and tell her, honey, this is what worked for me. And I know some people in the Los Angeles area. There's this guy named Keith. You give him a call if you want to. And I hung up that phone, and boy, tears just streamed down my eyes because I saw myself coming out here, you know, to pick her up and take her back in a casket. And that didn't happen. And it was a whole different level of surrender for me because, you know, I had put my life, and it had worked for me, and I had seen so many others, and now I had to put my baby's life in the hands of the same God that got me sober. And the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous is extended here in California. You know, this coming July the 21st, you know, Sarah, who's sitting here in the front row, you know, will celebrate 3 years of continuous sobriety in the Pacific Group in L.A. You know, and I'll finish up by saying this, is that, you know, you can't sometimes put into words, you know, our stories. You know, you're in an area of Hollywood where all the greatest scripts in the world are written. And yet none of the scripts that I've heard in Alcoholics Anonymous come close to the ones that they could write. Because real miracles happen here every day. Real lives are saved. You know, we kid around and we have a great time in this program, but we're talking about real lives because, you know, there's a fine line between us here today in this room and the people tonight on the 6 o'clock news. Fine line. And I never, ever want to forget that, you know, and I don't forget that because I come to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Keith and Sally, I would be remiss if I didn't say to you especially because you were so important in beginning this part. God used you to bring this part of my story and my journey. And to watch the two of you, you know, I do have a marriage today and I'm working as best I can. And to come out here and see you and to see the love and to see how you take care of Sally. And to see Sally, you know, with her sickness, with a smile on her face every day. You know, what a gift that is. I want both of you to know how much I love you. Thanks for having me. Thank all of you. I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic.
You've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com. Thank you.